Were you born on a farm?
No, I was born very near here, though, in the country. My grandfather was a... he had 5 miles of railroad track that went from Colfax to Applegate that he was the sort of the road foreman for, that he had to maintain the track, and we lived right beside the railroad tracks. And it was a nice, you know, it was a nice place in the country. It looked very much like this, except there was a railroad tracks in the front yard.
He was responsible for maintaining that 5 miles, or was there more track?
No, he just had a 5 mile stretch. Maybe it was about 15 miles. Actually, I think it went from Colfax to Applegate.
And you lived there until you went to the city, or into San Francisco?
Well, I was born near there, and lived around that area. We moved a lot. My father worked for the railroad too, and I lived there till I was about 4. And then during the war, my father, when I was 6 or 7, my father went in the Marine Corps during the Second World War, and we came to live with my grandmother again during that time. So I lived there for about. Well, the duration of the war was 4 or 5 years.
And then you lived in, that was in San Francisco.
From then on, I was just moving. Yeah, I lived in Redding a lot, up in Northern California, and we lived in L.A. for a few months. I mean, it seems like our family was always moving.
Do you feel that, do you feel that it's important that you're here? I mean, do you feel that you have roots, or is it just... Is it some other reason?
Yeah, I really love this area, the Sierra Nevada mountains. I often wondered about that. People say you take birth in an area, you know, you select the place of your birth. And I always tried to figure out what it was why I came down in this strange little town, you know, in this area. But as I got older, I came to really see that it was one of the most harmonious places for my own nature, you know, to live in. I mean, I like the looks of the sky and the big trees coming up, and you know, it's very much like this. Even during the winter, you have the blue sky, and the nature is rugged, but it's also very productive. You can have a lot of trees and different kinds. And
it's mainly an animal farm culture, though. I mean, is there much farming around here?
Well, not the kind of, because it's mainly foothill country. It's hard to cultivate with tractors and stuff. There's a few flat places, and there are some farms, but mainly it's people, like in this area, it's mainly people who have little homesteads and they do their own gardening, and people up here are very much into self-sufficiency, trying to have a cow or a goat and a few chickens and a garden and a few trees, and trying to develop whatever land they have, which I think is a very good thing considering food shortages. And
yeah, you definitely feel
some people are even, like the sheep over here, they're spinning wool from those sheep and making their own clothes. And
I've been thinking since you told me that you were born around here that there might be some... You know, there's always that mystery about where your roots are, and I had never thought about that very much, except that it seemed to me more and more I was noticing that wherever I was, I never really felt at home. You know, so there must be some place that you feel at home.
That's true.
You come back to that place.
Well, I think in generally I feel, you know, the West Coast. I always was. Felt very good when I was living out here, around, especially San Francisco, Northern California, I'd say. When I was in New York for 4 or 5 years, I really felt transplanted. I mean, I couldn't relate. I mean, I loved many things about New York, but I always was, my mind was always coming back here, you know, thinking about what's happening here. I'd dream a lot about just being here, you know, and long for this kind of environment. And I'd walk outside and there was the Bowery or Canal Street, you know. But I mean, New York has this other energy that, of course, for an artist is very important, I think. At least it was at that time.
Well, of course, it's
for me, you know, any
sort of center like that would be, you know, it pulls all that energy together.
I love to go there and play or, you know, do something.
Yeah. Well, you still go back a lot, don't you?
I'm through New York a lot, definitely, and sometimes I stop for a few days and see Lamont or Grugy.
Could you say something about your relationship to Lamont? Because you didn't grow up together.
No, we met. Would you like some more goat milk?
Yeah.
It's very good. Thank you, Coco.
Thank you, Coco. Ordinarily, you would just take this milk up to the house and freeze it and drink it today, huh?
Oh, yeah. We like to drink it. Anne and Sean, like, will have their cereal now this morning with it still warm like this. Sean seems to like it better when it's ripe.
You milk her twice a day, don't you?
Mm-hmm. Sometimes the neighbor will come by and get a quart of goat's milk, or we give it to people, or we feed it to the chickens. I mean, you always have more than you can use on.
I saw somebody working in your garden yesterday. Is that because you were sharing it, or because they were just doing it for you? Or?
No, people that come up here usually like to do that, you know.
Just work.
Yeah, like almost everyone that comes here likes to get on the land and do something, either work in the garden, or people have come to build a fence or plant fruit trees, or it's nice, you know. We've always got some ongoing project because there's so much land and there's so much to do.
You really get a sense, especially around the house, you know, where we recorded what you'll see the music. The sense of everybody working.
Yeah.
Very strong.
Yeah.
Oh, about Lamont. We were, yeah.
Right. Lamont and I met at in Berkeley. I guess it was 1960 or 59. I can't remember which year it was, but it was around there. We were both graduate students there. Mm-hmm. And he was, of course, the weirdest guy there. You know, I mean, the most strange and bizarre, and his music and his ideas. And I was immediately attracted to what he was doing, because it just was... you know, at that time especially, I was, you know, when you're a student, you're every new thing that's coming in is so devastating, you know, when you discover what anybody's ideas were that you had never heard about, and they were different from the next person's. You just go through these phases of being knocked over, and his idea, we were the same age, was also like that, you know, even more so, because I felt my whole life very close to what he has inspired, you know, these long durations, and his way of approaching the tones, getting really into the tones. So I went to composition seminars, and of course Lamont never could fit in as well with those. people would really, most of the people in the seminar just thought it was completely insane. But we started working together, and we did a lot of playing together, improvising, and at that time just exploring acoustical sounds, because electronic music hadn't gotten any, you know, it was just beginning to develop, you know. At that time there were no synthesizers and
no electric keyboards. No. Well, you were playing in a kind of jazz medium. I mean, Lamont, I've always thought that Lamont's improvising was so much like jazz.
No, actually, at that time I was not doing jazz. I was really into playing classical music. I mean, I was playing a lot of piano and playing a lot of, still at that time, Bach and Webern and Schoenberg and anything, Bartok and Debussy and French people, French Mio, and, you know. I was very interested in piano. And Lamont and I used to play two pianos a lot together, two at that time.
In the duration style? I
mean, yeah, just kind of free improvisations,
yeah. Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
There were other people too at that time. Dennis Johnson from Los Angeles, Terry Jennings.
I know Terry. Yeah.
And people used to come up, and we would do concerts and at Hertz Hall. Lamont had organized some really strange happenings there.
Burning violins. Yeah. Like you guys. Yeah. But you know, but your music to me, it has a jazz feeling. Do you admit that? I mean, are you interested in that?
I think so. I think
it.
I think, well, I'd say that I thought about this a few times about the what it is. Jazz is a very broad term. I think jazz is a part of it, and what it seems to be is that the land that you live in has a very heavy impact on the rhythms of the land that you live in, and the, you know, just the sun, the way the sun affects you, and the way the ground and the trees are. Yeah, and in this part of the world, in America, let's say in general, there's definitely a certain kind of energy which is hard to avoid. It like magnetizes us in a certain way. So I think jazz developed in this country because of those energies, because of, well, first of all, because of the black people who were transplanted here and had to develop a new, you know, their culture again because they were just lifted out by the roots. And then they picked up, because of their sad feeling and everything, they picked up from, you know, that and the land and everything and developed a gospel and all this. And then that developed into a kind of improvised music eventually, which we call jazz in a very broad form today. But I think that there are so many factors involved that for people where they're living, it's not just one thing, but many, many things come in to form their musical ideas, you know.
Yeah, certainly.
I certainly feel that there's some of the things about jazz, you know, the kind of flow or energy of the music certainly has affected me.
Yeah. Well, your interest in Indian ideas always makes me expect it to be more influenced by Indian music than I'm always surprised every time I hear the music to find that American feeling and that jazz feeling so strong, you know, in the music.
I think many of the aspects of Indian music have entered into the music that I'm doing, and I find that them natural and that they're very beneficial. You know, for instance, you could take the example of India itself. Like India is such an old tradition, you know, thousands of years of an ongoing, continuing culture, especially like in music, where you have, we don't know how many thousands of years of development, but there was no change like we had in the West, where one composer topples the one in front of him with a new revolutionary style. In India, you had each one, at least more or less, you had this, each one building on what came before, so that raga wasn't trying to destroy what came before, but to actually become more rich. And when the Mughals came in, they would bring the Persian culture to India and the Persian instruments and some of their, you know, things of their language and culture, but it got absorbed because this was always so old, it couldn't destroy what was there before. It was so strong and built on such really sound principles. I think, that's an example of a culture doing that, and if a person in his work has a very strong idea about what he wants to do, it's the same way. I mean, although many cultures or many ideas will come in, he can sort of keep an ongoing direction to his work. I think that's what happens to a lot of, I mean, that's what happened is for many Americans, is that they can't, I mean, they don't just do Indian music, but it's what the good things of that music, what they can use or what they can understand, they can incorporate in their work.
The tuning systems and the rhythmic figures are sort of obvious. Since I don't know as much about Indian music as I should for this question, but do the forms of, say, the pieces that we recorded, do they come out of an Indian formal tradition, or is that...
I was doing those forms before, and I haven't changed the form so much because of Indian music. I think what... Actually, on the organ, you know, it's not possible to do the real essence of Indian music, because Indian music, the main essence is that of alap, what's called alap, which is the manifestation of the atmosphere of the raga. Like you have whatever shapes the notes take and the particular melodic forms that are in that. That's the slow section at the beginning when a musician first starts to sing or play. He has to manifest the atmosphere of the raga or manifest the deity. Each raga is actually a manifestation of some divine essence, right? So this is the first principle, is to establish this, right? And the music is very linear and serpentine. I mean, it's not like Westerners think more in steps like pyramids being built, right? But Indians think more of forms that are always like this in music. They don't think of that you're going back, blink, 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 you know?
To get up to someplace.
Yeah, to get, you're always moving in a very serpentine manner. So, because I play organ, it's very hard to, because that's an instrument built on steps, it's very hard to actually do anything that's really like Indian music. But what I try to do is to manifest an atmosphere with the organ that captures you right away.
Mm-hmm. Wait, do you mean that the instrument should be inflected more than it is, or I mean just melodically inflected?
Well,
or,
I don't know if it's the, you know, I mean, some people say, well, you could build an organ so it's the keys are sensitive so they can all move one to the other, mm-hmm, smoothly, right? There's actually more involved in it than that, and I'm not sure that organ is the right instrument. I think organs do very well what they do, you know, and to try to change their nature into something else,
yeah,
is not necessary. I mean, it's really beautiful that they can create a very cosmic, universal sound. I mean, organs, even from the time of their beginning, really had a fantastic atmosphere and big bass and big, full, you know, cosmic feeling. So I don't think it's, my aim isn't necessarily either to change the organ that much, although I think certain things can be improved too.
I was just wondering about that, the statement of creating the rag, you know, for each, you know, the alaf.
Yeah.
In Indian music, that would be, is it a matter of inflecting the pitches, or is it a matter of the order of the pitches, or not so much in Indian music, but in your pitches, in your music?
Well, in my music, what I'm, my music, I hate to use a term,
well,
like
I want
to, but in this music that I'm doing, there, it's hard to find, actually say what is the, what makes it happen, mm-hmm, necessarily, any one thing that makes it happen, you know, to express the feeling. But I think that a lot of it has to do with the design of the patterns, the designs of the integrated patterns that make the way they move against each other, that kind of make an effect that a person can visualize.
Yeah.
You know, and so you don't have so much of that in Indian music necessarily, although it does exist in certain forms, like for instance when there are groups of instruments playing percussion or things like that, you can get, mm-hmm, maybe it relates even more to other musics like Balinese or Javanese.
Is that an improvised manner when in your music, when you make one of those long sort of statements that's made up of four or five figures or something like that, are those relationships improvised, or is that a fixed thing that you do?
No, they're improvised. What I do is I work out certain patterns, right, that I, and I practice these a long time just in their straight form, just like an exercise. And those patterns start ingraining themselves in my consciousness after a long time and develop into new patterns, right? And so that after a while, the original pattern almost becomes forgotten. And sometimes, like, the difference in a piece is that the evolution of the patterns, right, how they develop into a new shape. So that, for instance, a piece I was playing in 1966, I'm still playing today, but the original pattern has kind of disappeared. It's convoluted into an entirely different shape. So even though I consider it the piece I was playing in 1966, it's still a different.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. But even in more detail, when you start on a pattern, like the ones that we'll hear in the recording, there's a very definite sort of pattern. Then it seems to develop, but I can't tell whether that's
improvisation,
or whether that's just an enlargement of something that you've already practiced.
No, I mean, it's not. That part isn't isn't fixed,
yeah.
In the sense that, you know, like...
So each of these statements, long statements, is an original statement for that moment.
Right,
that,
right. That. I mean, if you go back and listen to a lot of recordings, if there was a way to, you know, compare, they'd never come out the same because they are improvised.
Yeah.
That's one of my main loves in music is the continual ongoing differences of form, you know, the forms of these patterns take. I think it's fantastic that certain moments can create a whole different viewpoint on those patterns, you know.
The organ that you use, though, is tuned for each of the pieces that you play.
Yeah, it's been modified so that you can easily tune it. And since all the music I play is modal music, set in a fixed mode, and there's no modulation, or there's no major modulations that will involve a change of tuning. It's the most practical way to do it, is to fix it in the actual intervals that you want, instead of accepting the equal temperament, which is designed for modulation.
Yeah. Is there some hierarchy of or some meaning to, like, the key that you pick for any particular piece?
Yeah, it seems like certain areas have resonances that enforce the atmosphere of the pieces, and I find it, like, if I try to transpose a piece, sometimes I've done that into another key and I don't like it as well, it doesn't resonate with the same power. So there are certain areas that help. I don't...
Could we talk a little bit about your singing? I wanted to ask you about your studies with Pandit Pranath, and you could talk about that if you like.
Sure.
I'd sort of like to know what you intend to do with the singing, because one time you told me that one responsibility of the singing was, you thought, to preserve some of these musical traditions that were thousands of years old and that you imagined would move to different, be taken to different parts of the earth, you know, but still be preserved in some way.
That's true. Actually, the music of Pandit Pranath that I'm studying is even in India a rare type of tradition, which is very slim. I mean, as far as I can see, he's the embodiment of that tradition today. And there's
he alone.
Yeah, there's some of the major disciples of that tradition have all passed on. So that's why there's many efforts being made today to try to preserve, even in recorded form, some of these really rare compositions that are, nobody could write them down, or there was no way to preserve them in any form before phonograph recordings or tape recordings. And many of those musicians wouldn't allow them. They felt that was fixing, you know, their strong feelings about spontaneity and improvisation and using this music for devotion to God instead of, you know, entertaining people, prevented them from doing any kinds of recordings. And so I really feel strongly that this is one of the most important musics. Its effect on the being of people who experience it, either as listeners or performers, is really profound, you know. And the thing is that it's, of course, impossible for a person to learn at all. I mean, like he was saying, each student only learns a little part of what his teacher knew, you know. So it kind of is a diminishing thing anyway. And of course, because we started late and we're Americans and we don't have that access to all the music, it means that will be able to preserve some aspects of it, I'm sure, and even help pass them on. There are certain things about the music which I think are possible to grasp and to transmit, and that is like the approach to the tones, the approach to the voice culturing, that you know how to produce the sound in the body, which goes way back into yogic techniques and, of sound, creating sound. These things can be learned. Of course, all the ragas and all the compositions, that would be too many.
He must know hundreds.
Yeah, he probably knows around 300 different ragas and maybe 600 compositions.
But how does that differ from the other Indian music?
Primarily today, I mean, as we can observe, what the situation is. The differences are is that the attention to the really elaborate detail of the raga in the Kirana tradition is much greater. Like you'll hear, it's hard to explain this if you don't, aren't familiar with a lot of different musicians, but most musicians, Indian musicians, don't know all the different places in the notes, the minute little areas to move into to create these really profound effects, like they stay more just on the centers of the notes themselves, and the way they move between the notes is not as elaborate and as meaningful. It's because, see, many ragas have the same scale, but like say many ragas have the scale C D E flat F G A B flat C, right? Our Dorian mode.
Yeah.
In India, this is a parent scale for just many, but they all these ragas. Have to have their own shape, so that means the way you move between these notes has to have a special effect, and that's what he's a real master at. He's preserved them all. He can improvise for hours on each one without repeating any.
Without slipping into another.
Yeah, it's an incredible, really incredible complex thing. I mean, I'm just always staggered by this, and this was the Kirana tradition, which. As I say, as far as I can tell, he's about the last person.
Are there other people? He's the last person. I mean, in other words, the line is sort of getting hard now.
Yeah,
but,
times.
But are there other people that are his colleagues? Like he would be a colleague of mine, or
No, most of those people. There are a few, but I don't think they are as far advanced as he is into it. He lived 20 years with his guru, so he really. And I consider him like, if you want to use the word genius, one of the geniuses of the time. I think I've never encountered a musical mind or being like his. It's just entirely devoted to music. I mean, he never thinks of anything else. And plus having all this talent to absorb things, And that alone is rare. I mean, there just aren't, I just never run into musicians like that. And so he doesn't have, that I can, as far as I can see, any other colleagues. And the other traditions that I've seen in Indian classical music don't have this, they don't have this attention to the detail of the raga either. So, I mean, to my view, that this is the end of this particular line as far as most of the body of the material, And it would have to be rediscovered or recreated.
Do you intend to sing in your style? Are you also working on it?
Well, I don't have too many intentions as far as the music goes. I do sing a lot. Most of my practice is singing practice, and for me, it's a devotional exercise. I mean, music is my spiritual path, So that it's my way of trying to find out who I am, and what the nature of being on this planet is, and so singing is in some ways the closest contact to that, because the voice is so directly connected to the soul. I find that, and so as far as the aspects of whether I would ever want to do it in public, those aren't really. I would do it in public if the spiritual feeling was right. You know what I mean? If it felt like it was really a devotional exercise. I wouldn't want to just go out for money and sing or something like that, because to me it's the work itself is the most important thing. it's really a very closely connected thing to the being, singing is, and especially this music, because the music, as you sing this music more and more, it actually changes your whole attitudes and everything towards life. You know, you tend to become quieter and more alone and more introspective, and I mean, that's another reason I came out here, was because I found I couldn't really do the music in the city. There was too much artificial stimulation, you know, things, telephones and radios and things all going. And to really listen to the tones carefully and tune the tambour carefully and really listen, you need a quiet. But I want to, I mean, I just see myself, you know, as long as I can study with him, I would like to continue doing that and learn as much as I can and try to develop and pass on to other people who want to do it what I learn of it.
And you teach that now?
Yeah, I teach a lot, especially during when I'm at Mills. I teach a lot of vocal music, and I really enjoy it. And I mean, I really like to see the effect that it has when people get involved in doing it too, because it's a very engaging thing. You know, a person starts sitting down with a tambour every morning and listening to his voice, and he really starts discovering things about himself and sound and his body and everything that are quite amazing.
Yeah, I can imagine that would be. Is there a tradition for there being an obligation to teach? Say, I mean, do you feel, for instance, do you feel that you are obligated to pass it on to someone else, or do you, you know, in the West, there's always a point where. Or at least there's the tradition of not teaching, you know, the unexplained music.
Mm-hmm.
And I've wondered. It seems to me that in Indian music there's more of a tradition of explaining your.
Well, it is, because see, it's so difficult in the first place that you can explain forever and it'll still be a great secret.
Yeah.
I mean, and you can because everybody it's such a difficult path to develop it. It's better to start explaining, and again, it's in its most effective state. It's a spiritual communion, you know. It's like you and the student are in a state of in the best lessons. The student and the teacher are in a state of God intoxication, because you're both dealing with the raga, and it's not like a music lesson. It's like something else, you know. And with the best students, I mean, the students who feel this way about it, I find it just incredible to teach or to have when I have a lesson from Guruji, I mean, it's some of the greatest moments I remember of my life, when he's just sort of opened up something for me that I never could have imagined, you know.
So you'll keep on teaching probably in your career.
Oh yeah, in fact, teaching, and Guruji says this too, teaching and learning are the same things. I mean, when teaching is a learning experience, because in order to teach, you have to examine the thing very closely, so you're learning yourself what its nature is.
Yeah. Well, there's been a kind of paranoia or, you know, sadness about so many American composers feeling that their teaching is an obligation, that an unwanted one, you know, mm-hmm. something that they shouldn't be doing, that they really should be. They should be doing something that removes them from that, you know, or
mm-hmm.
frees them from that. And I haven't sensed that in you. And so many of the people that I know take the teaching with mm-hmm. a real sort of devotion. You know,
yeah. Well, of course, you couldn't teach to the point, especially if you're a performing musician and you want to keep developing, you have to guard a certain space for your own development. I mean, if you taught 18 hours a day before you were really developed yourself, there'd be certain aspects of your own training or own learning that it couldn't be covered, you know. So I like teaching, but of course it would be,
yeah.
you know, up to the limits that I can still do the work that I want to do.
The limits are just your
time.
Your time and the amount of and what that relationship does to you.
Right, and I also am mainly interested in teaching people who are attracted to the ideas, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't want to go out like a missionary and try to hit people that aren't interested. I mean, that would be a waste of energy. If people are already making steps towards this, then it's a good idea, you know. But otherwise, I think there's just not that much energy to.
Besides your own playing and your studies with Andy Pranat, do you listen to other music? Is there a sort of a schedule that you have for being in touch with other music?
Well, listening, it goes in periods. There are long periods where I don't hear any other music, and I think I purposely do it just to try to become in contact with the inner music that's going on, whatever is filtering through. But there are times, I find usually when I'm on tour, I get exposed to a lot of other music because, you know, you're staying at other people's houses and they want to play you records of somebody, musician that they find, you know, they find exciting. So I tend to hear more music when I'm on tour than I do when I'm at home. It's kind of interesting that tour time is always a, you know, new impressions. And it's good too because you're playing yourself and it's a very vital
time of being in the world. That's true for everybody.
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess I don't listen to music at home. I don't have a hi-fi or anything, you know.
Yeah. Occasionally especially if I don't feel too inspired sometimes and I want to take some energy from another musician, I'll go listen to a record I really like, you know, and then my mood's lifted and I can go back to work. Yeah. It's nice. I mean, it's really, there's a few records that I just listen to over and over again.
Like, what are those?
Well, Guruji's tapes, of course, because they're my, you know, my main love. And the other things are they're mainly Indian music. I mean, they are Indian music. Bhadi Ghulam Ali Khan is a really wonderful singer, Abdul Karim Khan. I listen to Ali Akbar Khan playing Sarod because I think he's feeling full. Other, you know, Bismillah Khan, many.
Is there any kind of music that is close enough to your music so that to the music that you play at the keyboard, so that you feel related to it, or that you are interested in?
I don't take inspiration really from any other keyboard, especially at the present time. I mean, maybe earlier in my life I was, but right now it's its own cycling machine. I mean, I have to really work everything out through the ideas that are coming out of that piece. There are other, you know, things that I hear occasionally that I find, you know, quite good, and groups that are starting to work with some of these ideas, but their direction and because of their feeling and everything is different, you know. After a while, I mean, you know, as you get older and everything, your own work starts developing. It almost compels you to follow certain things in it, you know.
Yeah.
At least that's what I find. It's an ongoing. It's like if you're building a house, you know, with bricks like this, and you just suddenly couldn't come out and stack bricks to the side of it, you know, they'd fall down. So it kind of has its own ongoing structure. And
well, I've noticed about the people that I've been thinking about this last few years. I mean, you and the other people that are recorded on these tapes. Everybody seems to share that. I mean, everybody seems to be to have that same feeling of wanting to pull in and develop some personal part of themselves, you know. But so many other kinds of music, there's a very strong tradition for just listening through.
Uh-huh.
I mean, for instance, in jazz.
Pop musicians. You know, by listening, I noticed most pop musicians I know have stacks of records and they listen to all the other groups.
But in the Western classical music too, you listen to a lot of music. And it seems to me that one of the parts of the way this music has developed is that kind of very private quality of all the people who are trying to develop something in that area, you know. group talk so much you can't even hear the animals. Are you working on a new piece now? You mentioned that you'd been playing one of the pieces that we recorded since 1966. That was Rainbow and Curvature.
Yeah, I played one of the ongoing versions of that yesterday. Yeah, yeah. And
then the piece we recorded yesterday, the other piece is that you mentioned to me that you were working on a new piece or a new way of playing.
Well, I'm working on, yeah, I didn't play that because that's still, being worked out more. Yeah, that is actually not, that's something that got started this year. It's taking a slightly different kind of structure in that the beginning patterns don't seem to be as fixed as the other ones were, you know. It's kind of like more like water. I mean, they have certain things that are fixed in them, but they're more minute. And what I mean is it runs like water over rocks, you know. It kind of just ripples. And in the kind of improvisation technique is a little different and more difficult to keep on the tracks. So I'm working on that, and it's, I love what's coming out. It's really becoming quite feelingful and effective.
How long will it take you to get to that piece to a place?
You can never tell, you know. Sometimes pieces gel in a day.
Really?
You know? Yeah, I mean, for instance, you'll work for 6 months or 8 months, and you'll think, well, I've another year, maybe I'll have. And then just one time like that, everything will just come and fall into place. It's, music is so impossible to determine, you know. It's just grace coming from the outside that sometimes creates certain beautiful pieces. You know, you think, oh, I couldn't do this, or.
And then when that point comes, when it gels, then you don't mind other people hearing it. Is that true?
Well, it's I don't mind other people hearing it necessarily. It's just that until I'm really satisfied myself, I don't feel it's the piece yet. You know, I mean, when I'm practicing it or something, there's a certain point where it's you can develop a confidence in working with it, which then it becomes more enjoyable, you know. In some pieces, like I find that out of all performances that I do, like only once every maybe 2 or 3 years I'll do a performance that really begins to satisfy me in terms of, you know, I think, well, that I really like listening to the tape afterwards. Most of the time I find, you know, that it doesn't, my expectations were too high or something for it, you know, and it doesn't come up to that. And sometimes, like, you'll play in a concert and that will be it'll be the high point of that piece, and it never comes back to that form that high again, you know. And then I just have to change and start regenerating the material again, different themes and different.
How many pieces are you actually playing now? How many things are you maintaining?
Well, it's become so, branched out now that it would really be hard to say. I mean, I'd say there are like maybe 4 or 5 main stems.
Yeah.
You know.
But each of the ones.
And then when
the
I concert, it's just like a branch, right? With this many, you know, that when you do a concert of those stems, it's just.
But the ones that I know that of yours, there are definite rhythmic patterns and definite rhythmic feelings, and
right.
Those I consider those different pieces.
Right.
Are they?
Yeah, they're all different. I mean, what I do is there's a group of like thematic ideas and stuff that go with each one, each individual one, and then sometimes the way the patterns are made up, or the key or the mode, that determines the main stem of the thing, you know. It's like in raga, you have apparent scales that launch many ragas.
Do you have a a kind of process or formula that you can refer to in each piece in order to find new material? Or do you let the material sort of just pop out of you when you're practicing?
Usually the new material pops out of practicing an old piece,
yeah.
And that becomes so strong in itself that it launches out a new.
So you don't have an actual interior process that you use for developing new patterns? And
the only process is practice. I practice a lot, you know, and working on those pieces, and then, no, that's the only way they evolve, is that they almost without exception will come jumping out of another piece by themselves. I mean, so the main goal is not to try to create new pieces, really. It's that the new pieces are created. I mean, you know, there's no intention to do that, but through practice they come. So the composition isn't necessarily an intent. I used to find that a hang-up when I was writing music. Somebody say, "Oh, we need a piece for bassoon and clarinet and French horn," you know. And, you know, when I was about 18 or something, I'd sit down and
start writing,
you know, and keep working until something did come, you know. But it was such a hard way to do, you know. Of course, age has a lot. I mean, as you get older, it helps you a lot. Well, just your body of material grows, you know.
I guess we're almost through.
An hour is almost gone. Well, thank you for coming to the Moonshine Ranch, Bob.
An hour is so easy. we could just sit here quietly. And
well, as the sun gets up more and more, it'll
look around the ranch.
These are Buddhists.
Yeah.
These little booms. It's really alive.
They make the biggest sounds for being such, for their size, I think, of any animal, don't they?
Gosh, I don't know what to drink. Would you like more milk?
Oh, yeah.
You're doing pretty well for a new.
Sort of rich,
truly off.